So let's look at 1 Peter 5, and what we were talking about in this section, the first four verses or so, is the responsibility of the elders. The Apostle Peter speaking as an elder, indicating that there are certain responsibilities that they had. Feeding the flock of God, verse 2, which is among you, taking the oversight thereof, not by constraint but willingly, not for filthy lucre but of a ready mind, neither as being lords over God's heritage but being examples to the flock. And when the chief shepherd shall appear, you shall receive a crown of glory that fades not away. I just noticed that I'm in the King James Version instead of the New King James, where I typically am, so let me make that change. Okay, so what we want to do is talk a little bit about some of these things very quickly. The questions that we've asked, and where we're at is with the third question in this section. After we've defined and explained what the term shepherd, overseer, and elder indicated, the question that I had here is in verse 2, this statement that he is not to serve for filthy lucre, or as the New King James renders it, for dishonest gain. What's meant by that? And there are a couple of points that I wanted to make. And again, as we make these, if there is anything you want to add, if you can make some concise comments, we'll try to get through this as soon as possible. But the word filthy lucre that's found in this particular text is translated by Strong as an eagerness for base gain. And the idea is, you know, some gains are legitimate, some gains are not. So the idea is that I begin to serve as an elder for what I can get out of it. It's an indicative of an impure motive and of some benefit that accrues to me because of the way I serve as an overseer. So there are a couple of things that come to mind as possibility in this. One is the qualification, 1 Timothy 3:3, with regard to the eldership. One of the qualifications is not greedy for money. This probably is the primary application here, is that I don't know exactly what he was referring to at this time. It's kind of hard for us, I suppose, to conceive that in the first century that elders could serve in such a way as to get money out of it. There are a couple of thoughts. One is that elders who serve well are worthy of double honor, indicating that elders can be supported in the work that they do. It would certainly be inappropriate for an elder's motivation in serving as overseer to be so that he'll get paid. It's just the same as a preacher. I mean, I could not feed my family. I could not have a house over my roof over my head if I didn't get support in the preaching that I do. But if I decided that I'm not going to preach on a particular subject, or I'm going to preach in a particular way so that I do not jeopardize my support, so that maybe more people will, because I'm compromising, be willing to come and to listen to me, so that the support might grow. You know, those kinds of decisions are wrong for a preacher, and they're also wrong for one who's serving in the capacity of oversight. There's a text in Isaiah 56 and verse 11 that I think parallels this pretty well, where the leaders of Israel were admonished here in this text. He said, they're greedy dogs, which never have enough. They are shepherds who cannot understand. They all look to their own way, everyone for his own gain, for his own territory. And that's what's being inveighed against in this particular text. Now, it may not be necessarily overtly for money. It may be that an individual serves an oversight in such a way as to maybe increase his own influence, his own standing, and then maybe in a secondary way benefit monetarily from that. But it's basically the concept of having the wrong motivation. And I think that's pretty obvious when you look at this in several ways. When you serve, you're not to serve because you feel you have to, but because you want to. That's not by compulsion or willingly. So that's indicative of motive. And then also not for dishonest gain, but then eagerly. In other words, I'm wanting to do the work. I'm not doing it so that I can get something out of it. So that's basically what's being indicated by that. And I think, too, that there's a tertiary application we can make, and third down the line. And sometimes I think that elders will make decisions with regard to oversight to, let's say, grow a congregation, whether it be influence or numerically, but by compromising. In other words, their concern is less standing for truth and more how can we get the people in? You see that specifically with regard to the denominations, but it's certainly something that could happen in the Lord's church as well, where I don't want the preacher to be preaching on this particular subject because it might run some people off. I want us to engage in this particular activity. It may not be authorized by Scripture, but it's something that will bring the people in, so we're going to do these things. And I don't know that in the Lord's church, especially among faithful congregations, that that's as much a concern, but it certainly can be seen to have happened in other places. So that's question number one. See how quickly we got through that one? I'm the only one talking. Anybody have anything they have to add? Okay, nothing I have to add. Let's go to the second one then. What about the idea of not being lords over, but rather being examples? This has to do somewhat with regard to, again, demeanor and attitude, the approach you take as serving as an overseer, and the basically way you go about exercising oversight. And these are the two possibilities. One is serving as lords. The word lord in this particular passage is indicative of the one who is in control. When we talk about the lordship of Jesus Christ, we submit ourselves to His will. He has all authority. And that was typically the case. You remember in Jesus' discussion with His disciples concerning who will be the greatest. He said it was the practice of the Gentiles. The rulers of the Gentiles lorded over them, but among you it shall not be so. Whoever desires to become great among you, let him be a servant. And so that's that servant leadership that you hear about. You know, we talk about that. It's very common to hear that phrase, servant leadership, associated with the husband in the home. You hear that quite a bit, even in the denominational world. Servant leadership. And the idea is, I am the head of the home, but my responsibility as head is the welfare of those in my charge. It's not so that I get to do what I want, that I always get my will, that what I say goes, but rather I am in a position where God holds me accountable to make sure that what is best for the group is done. And so I am the leader, but it is a servant leadership. I have a service, a ministry that I am responsible for as the husband in the home, as the father in the home. The same thing with regard to the elders. It indicates that it is not an authoritarian thing. It is something to where you certainly lead by example. Now, we do want to emphasize that when it says lead by example, there are some who have gone so far as to say that all eldership is being an example, that there is no authority in the office. Well, there is authority intrinsic in the word overseer. We've already talked about that last week. And so it's difficult to note the concept of oversight without noting that there are some who are under the oversight. So there's some subjugation or submission there. Hebrews 13 very clearly indicates the need for us to submit to those who are over us, those who have that authority over us. So there is that responsibility. But what it has to do is the way in which the men who serve in that capacity pursue that office, not to be domineering.
Yeah, well, in verse 5 it says, be subject to your elders, and be humble, humility toward one another. So, you know, the elders are going to be humble. They're going to set the example for humility.
Good. Very good. Yeah. And should. Yeah, certainly. That's an important point to make. I gave one example of the type of lording it over. It's not an elder. I don't know of any examples of the elders disregarding this that's revealed overtly in Scripture, but there is a man in 3 John by the name of Diotrephes, who is a good description of one who seeks dominance. Diotrephes in verse 9 said he loves to have the preeminence among them, brethren in that particular congregation, and as such he would not receive John and those who are with him. He said, if I come, I will call to mind his deeds, which he does. He prates against us with malicious words, and not content with that, he does not receive the brethren and forbids those. I'm not going to do it, and you aren't going to do it either, and if you do it, I'm kicking you out. That's the attitude that Diotrephes had. So that kind of action is something that certainly would be a violation of this call here in 1 Peter 5. Okay? All right, so that gets us through the section with regard to the eldership. And again, we didn't cover it completely, but we're running out of time. So the next section is found in verses 5 through 11. This concept of being submissive to one another. Younger people, submit to your elders. Yes, all of you be submissive to one another and be clothed with humility. For God resists the proud but gives grace to the humble. Therefore, humble yourselves under the mighty hand of God that He may exalt you in due time, casting all your care upon Him. for he cares for you. And we'll stop there and just make note of that first question, and that is, what does it mean for all of you to be submissive to one another? I remember talking to a man who, in a Bible class, I was visiting a congregation, and he talked about the fact that husbands are to be submissive to wives. I mean, wives are to be submissive to their husbands, but the husbands are also to be submissive to the wives. And he took this passage out of context, by the way, to establish that point. And again, in his way of teaching this particular class, and I know the man well, and in his good intentions, he didn't want to be guilty of seeming to be like these lorded over the flock elders were in that regard. When it talks about submitting to one another, it cannot mean that there is not hierarchy that exists in culture, in the family, in government, in the church. I mean, we are called in Ephesians 6, children are called to be obedient to their parents, wives in 1 Peter 3 are to be submissive to their husbands, in Romans chapter 13, we as citizens are to be submissive to the governing authorities. And the same type of call is given in the church. I alluded to Hebrews 13 a moment ago. In verse 17, the call is to obey those who rule over you and be submissive. So there is that hierarchical relationship to where you have one who is serving as an overseer, and those who are in the capacity of, or those who are members in their capacity of overseer, we have a responsibility to be submissive to them. And he says not only that, but to do so so that they can serve in their office with joy and not grief, because that would be unprofitable to you. That's as close, about as close to a threat as you're going to get in Scripture with regard to just the general admonition. It's not going to be, God's not going to like it if you cause grief to the elders, is the point being made. So it's not talking about the hierarchical reality that exists in the church or in our homes or in government and that kind of thing. What it is talking about is indicated from the context is humility. This is the idea that we should have, and it's established very, very clearly in Philippians chapter 2 with regard to the humility shown by Jesus, who, though he was in a position of exaltation at the right hand of the Father, he made himself of no reputation, came in the form of man, in the form of a servant, and died on the cross for us. And that humility, that selflessness that was shown by Jesus is one that should be present with regard to each of us as well. There is a similar phrase that is used in Ephesians 5 in verse 21, where we're told to submit to one another in the fear of God. And what, so practically, what does that mean? What that means is that an issue or a conflict arises. It may be a personality conflict, it may be personal preferences or whatever among Christians. How is that to be handled? Well, the way it's to be handled is for me to say, not my will, but yours. In other words, not look out only for my own interest, but also look out for the interest of others, as Philippians 2 tells us. And when it takes two to argue, and arguing or conflict always exists when an individual is seeking to press his will over another, to dominate another individual. If you've got a bunch of people who are unwilling to be those who try to dominate, and by the way, the elders are not to be trying to dominate. They're not to serve as lords, but rather as examples. If you have that mindset of it's not about me, it's about you, my concern is not for me, but for you, and you have the same feeling toward me, it's going to work. And that's the call. That's the idea that's found here as far as being submissive to one another. Okay? Comments, questions? Yes, Dick?
Yeah. We were looking for a quick answer. And that it says that younger people submit yourselves to your elders. Is that the overseers or those people that are older than the young people?
Well, the elders are in the context, certainly in the preceding verses, the first four verses, it's specifically talking about elders. But I think that I don't know that we can take verse 5 and limit it only to the elders of the congregation. And certainly if it is limited to that contextually here, which I don't think it is, but if it is, there are any number of other passages which indicate the same responsibility to those who are older in general. And yeah, I mean, young people, there are a few of you in here. That's something, and Josh isn't one of them. But you are here, most of you. Anyway, you have a responsibility to be submissive to those who are older and acknowledge their wisdom and experience and to be deferential in your treatment of them. That's kind of a reality that God expects of all of us. And we were talking about that a little bit in ladies' Bible class this morning. And we were talking about how children are to obey their parents. And after a while, they grow up and they leave and you don't have that same control. Well, Patsy says she does over her kids. And I think there's some truth to that. There's always that responsibility to have that submissiveness to your parents.
In respect for
mm-hmm. deference to, you know, those kinds of things.
And I was trying to get up to all those verses that you were giving, and I read in some of them, but the thing that just comes to my mind is the lesson that all Christians, the best thing we can do is be servant. And one of them I read were like Christ.
Right, sure. Well, Philippians 2.
Philippians, yeah. Clear. And yeah, so, exactly. To me, that's kind of what this is underlying. I mean, instead of seeking to be the one on top and getting, if there's a bunch of praise or whatever, instead of seeking to be that one, seek to be the one that does it without expecting any praise.
Very good. Very good. The next question is very much like this one. I asked that you supply other verses that discuss the importance of humility and how to exhibit that spirit of humility in our relationship with other people. And I think that text of Philippians 2 is the one I most often refer to, and how the relationship is. Understand this. A humble heart is exhibited by selfless action. We might say a selfless heart is exhibited by humble action. So it's kind of, I don't know which comes first, the chicken or the egg, but the whole point of this is when you're outside of yourself and not concerned with self, because you understand that self is unimportant, and what is more important is the welfare and benefit of others, then that's going to, you're going to have a humble demeanor. But understand that it's not something that you profess. I keep using the same illustrations, and those of you who have known me this long, you've heard it before, but in the Screwtape Letters, there was a demon tormentor who was telling his nephew tormentor, who was tormenting this one and tempting this one man. He was upset with him because the man had found humility. And he said, well, that's a terrible thing, because you don't want your guy to be humble. You've got to get him out of this. Well, how do you do it? Well, have you reminded him that he's humble? Because if you remind him that he's humble, then he can become prideful of his humility. Look at me, how humble I am. And then he said, but don't do it too often, because then he sees the absurdity of it and he'll just laugh and go his way. But if you can get a person to, and there are an awful lot of people that do that, they're so, look at me, look how pious
I am.
Look how wonderful a person I am, because I'm not prideful like these other people are. Yeah, that's a danger. It really can be a danger. But that danger comes again when you're focused on yourself. Look at me, look how I am. This is the way. But if you're looking at other people, you're selfless rather than selfish. Humility is something that naturally comes.
Well, when you were speaking, I was just thinking of 1 Corinthians 6. We've been in 1 Corinthians, and where they're taking each other to court.
Yeah.
And his answer to it is, why not rather be defrauded? That goes against every instinct we have.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
And it makes you think, it's not about me.
Right. And what Paul is saying is, this church is exploding. Why not take it? So that it's because that's what will be best for the church. And not what's best for you necessarily,
yeah.
What's best for the brethren. Yes, sir.
We're not to be respected persons as God is not a respected person.
Okay. Good. All right. The other verses that I have, we're not going to read them because of lack of time, but I just, if you've got a pen and want to write them down, passages that I wrote down with regard to humility, these are just some that you can allude to. Matthew 23:12. He who exalts himself will be humbled, he who humbles himself will be exalted. John 13:14-15, Jesus washing the feet of his disciples. Romans 12:3, not to think more highly of yourself than you ought to. Galatians 5, let us not be conceited. That's Galatians 5:6. And Colossians 3, holy and beloved, put on tender mercy, kindness, and humility as one of the calls. So those are some passages that are beneficial. There are a lot of them in Scripture. The Bible talks a lot about the need to be humble. Okay, then in verse 7 of the text, it says, "Humble yourselves under the mighty hand of God that he may exalt you in due time, casting all your care upon him." How do we cast our care upon God? Well, the reference, I think, is to Psalm 55:22. It doesn't state as a direct quote, but there is such a similarity. The psalmist said, "Cast your burden on the Lord, and he shall sustain you. He shall never permit the righteous to be moved." And so when we talk about casting our care, we recognize the difficulties of life, and specifically in this context, the difficulties of a life lived for Christ because of the persecution you'll experience as a result of that life. But if we commit, and I'll read a quote from Albert Barnes, I really like this. He said, "The meaning here is that we're to commit our whole cause to him. If we suffer heavy trials, if we lose our friends, our health, or property, if we have arduous and responsible duties to perform, if we feel we have no strength and are in danger of being crushed by what is laid upon us, we may go and cast all upon the Lord. That is, we may look to him for grace and strength and feel assured that he will be able to, or he will enable us to sustain all that is laid upon us." And so when, again, you're not taking it upon yourself, but you recognize that I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me, that I have that help from God, it unburdens us and we feel relief in the recognition that it's hard to get to heaven and we're going to suffer if we're trying to, but God is there with us and he's on our side. And with God's help, we can accomplish these things. Barnes says in this, "The relief in the case will be as real and as full of consolation as if he took the burden and bore it himself," which of course is a promise that he makes for us. His burden is light. The work is easy, the burden is light. Because God is with us. Okay, so I did want to keep in mind that. I know we're pushing through this, and I apologize for how quickly we're having to go. Watch this, I'll get to the very, very end. We'll have 10 minutes left. But I don't think that's going to happen.
Maybe not.
Look at verse 8 of the text. Now we're talking about the devil in this. So there's a little slight change in verses 8 through 11. "Be sober, be vigilant, because your adversary, the devil, walks about like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. Resist him steadfast in the faith, knowing that the same sufferings are experienced by your brotherhood in the world. But may the God of all grace, who has called us to his eternal glory by Christ Jesus, after you have suffered a while, perfect, establish, strengthen, and settle you. To him be the glory and dominion forever and ever. Amen." So the next few questions are about this section. I wanted, first of all, to define the term sober and vigilant. And again, for want of time, I'll just give you those definitions. The word sober means to be calm and collected in spirit, to be dispassionate and circumspect. So that term circumspect, it indicates a very specific path. When we're told to walk circumspectly, we're indicated we're to be careful. Now, you hear people talk about, with their demeanor, that, hey, you know, I'm just one of those people that are just out there, you know, and I'm all over the place. And you'll hear people talk about that as far as their emotions. And people will excuse themselves from time to time for blowing up because, well, you know, I've just got these raging emotions and I'm just kind of that kind of an extrovert. Well, being sober-minded means being in control of yourself and being careful. And that term dispassionate is, I think, a very important one. So we acknowledge and understand that as Christians we have joy, and we should have joy. The emotions that we enjoy because we are Christians are wonderful and beneficial and helpful to us. When we're talking about the dangers that lurk, and the fact that we've got an agent, the devil, who is an actual malevolent and real individual who is seeking our harm, we can't just be out there unfocused and unconcerned, because he's, every step we take in our life, he's trying to cause us to stumble. He's trying to bring us down. And so we've got to be careful. And so I'm not saying that you're not supposed to be emotional. What I'm saying, you've got to be serious. Serious-minded, careful in the decisions that you make, careful in what you say, careful in considering how you're going to appear before others, that your influence will be right and proper. It takes planning. It takes effort. It takes discipline. And that's what sobriety indicates, is someone who's very disciplined. Mentally disciplined. And perhaps less mentally, I mean, because mental carries with it the idea of truth, knowledge, and understanding. But the will, your will, what the decision-making process, what I'm going to do, what I'm determined to do, that has to be very carefully thought out as Christians. And I'm afraid that sometimes we don't practice the sobriety that we need to practice. We get caught up in a moment. That's the way temptation works. That's why lust is so destructive. Because we've got our plans, and then the devil comes along and throws these stones of stumbling in the way, or these distractions, and we start wandering and not following that purpose. And the sober-minded individual is going to do that. Vigilant is very similar in the idea or concept, but it means to watch. We're talking about watchfulness, to give strict attention to. I want to emphasize with regard to that statement is the awareness of the opponent. The awareness of our enemy. Vigilance is required of a sentry who is standing watch because the bad guys might come. Mm-hmm. And that's why he's not just looking around to see everything. He's looking around to see where the danger is or see if the danger is present. And so when we're vigilant with regard to a particular danger. And the danger is described in this text as Satan. As our adversary. And so, how does this help us resist? Well, you know, it's preparedness. The people who are blissfully unaware. Look at your children, for example. You're the one that has to grab them and pull them back from the street when they're toddlers because they're unaware of that car that's bearing down upon them. You know it. You've been watching for it. You've been watching to make sure they don't get to the street. Anytime they get close, you pull them away because they're unaware. And because they're unaware, they're in danger. And you're not going to let them get hurt. But when it comes to our lives as Christians, of course, we've got the elders. We've got those who are more mature who are looking out for the flock because ravenous wolves will come in. But we have a certain responsibility individually to be aware so that we all don't come to harm. And that's what it's calling for here in this particular text. All right. So questions, comments about that? Preparation to resist the devil. Next question then deals with the description of the devil. What does his description reveal about the devil? And so, of course, the metaphor is that he is walks about as a roaring lion seeking whom he may devour. And so that's the kind of concept I had in this question is that, you know, why did he pick a lion? And that's obvious, but I went to the zoo 6-8 months ago. I don't remember how long it was. We took Sawyer to the zoo. And it was the first time I have ever in person heard a lion roar. And I was shocked at how loud it was and how, I mean, just rumbling loud it was. It was really an impressive thing. And I never heard it before. I mean, I've heard it on TV and everything, but to be present. And he wasn't even mad. He was just vocalizing. And it was just you can imagine,
be out somewhere to do that.
Yeah, him standing, not a moat between me and him, and him doing that with his eyes on me. That's it's a very, very dangerous and capable enemy. That's the point that he's made here. He says, walking about whom he may devour, so he's ever hungry, and so he's always dangerous. And that's what we want to keep in mind. But I do want to emphasize that he is not an enemy which cannot be defeated, because he can be. And the text that I thought about in this relation is James 4:7, where we are given the promise that if we resist the devil, he'll flee from us. It's hard to get in our minds a lion running away. So we don't want to belabor that metaphor too much to where it becomes absurd. But Peter's talking about his danger. James is saying that despite his danger, if you actively resist him, he will leave you. And that's the promise that we're given from God. So we can be victorious despite how difficult it is.
And I think in these verses right here, it says this to some extent about the power of God. That if we, as you said, are prepared to turn our mind to learning more and what God has intended for us, there's our strength. It's not in us. But we've got to keep our eye on that and realize, don't wait till you're in dire straits before you start praying. You know, do your praying constantly, and he will answer.
Good. Yes, sir.
one thing to keep in mind that our God has more power in his little finger than Satan has in his whole being. And along with you saying about pleading the devil, you should connect yourself to God, and you're just the devil, he'll flee from you. And then, same thing, when we draw near to God, he'll draw near to us.
We have great protection.
Yes.
And yes, we can be invulnerable to his devices and efforts if we prepare ourselves sufficiently and depend upon God wholly. Yeah, we certainly can.
As you brought up before, that you don't wait till something comes up, you know, beforehand how you're going to react. You know, if you're in the store and the clerk leaves some money on the counter, but you don't have to know if you're going to take it or not. I mean, you automatically, you're not going to touch it, you know. And a lot of other things like that.
Yeah, that's right.
If you ever come to church tonight because I got to work or something, oh, you come to church, you know.
Yeah, that's good. It's important to be prepared because he's always trying for his son. Yeah, prepare for him. Good. The last two questions in this section are not as significant in my mind, but I do want to make note of a couple of things. The first question is, in verse 9, when it talks about the same sufferings being experienced by your brotherhood, do the words, knowing that the same sufferings are experienced by your brotherhood, have an impact on the idea of resisting? What I wanted to emphasize there is the recognition of our common suffering. You know, there's strength in numbers. We have a support group. We're not the only ones that are afflicted in this way. Everyone has that common foe. And knowing that we are not alone, there is comfort and there is strength. And had opportunity in a Bible study I had this afternoon to talk with a woman about the assembly. And I pointed out the fact that Hebrews 10 tells us we're not to forsake the assembling ourselves together. We emphasize that an awful lot and sometimes do not emphasize the reason for that. And the reason is not that you assemble because of what you get out of it. That's that selfishness we're talking about. You assemble because there are other individuals you have a responsibility to help and to edify and to exhort. Exhorting one another. And the wonderful thing about the way this works is that while I am a single individual and my focus is on the remaining brethren in the congregation, and I'm going to seek people out for the purpose of doing what I can to build them up and encourage them, I'm only one person in doing that. And I can only accomplish what one person can do. But at the same time I am doing that, I have in our congregation 70 people who are pointing toward me and wanting to help me and build me up. And if our focus is broad in that regard, where we're doing everything we can to help other people, whenever the sufferings happen, the persecutions happen, the trials, tribulations happen, when we're aware of it, if we're focused in ourselves and we're not involved with others, it's just us, and we're trying to handle it alone, it's going to be very, very difficult. But when we have that outpouring of love that is present, and other people are actively expressing that love to us during those difficult times, well, that makes it so much easier. And so that's if you remember this, you understand this, that yes, we have this very, very difficult foe, but we have all these people who are in the same boat as we are, and we can depend upon them, and we can help them, then it makes it much easier. And then the other question is, at the end of that, that after we have suffered for a while, the God of all grace will perfect, establish, strengthen, and settle us. And I thought that it was interesting. I think it was Barnes again that I was reading. Talked about how the suffering itself is something that perfects us. In other words, we are perfected in our suffering. Now, I think there's some truth to that. I understand that we're dependent upon God to receive these things. But I'm reminded of what James said in James 1 and 12, where we're told that if we endure temptation, when we have been approved, we'll receive the crown of life. And the fact that patience is sometimes received through our being long-suffering in the midst of our trials and tribulations. So persecution is something that can strengthen us. It certainly, as we maintain our faithfulness before God in the midst of it, it certainly is something that establishes us in God's eyes. And because we are faithful, and the best passage to establish is 2 Thessalonians 1, because he's talking about the Macedonians who themselves were suffering persecution, and he's talking about the individuals who are persecuting them, and he said it's a righteous thing with God to visit indignation on the wrath on the ones that are persecuting you, but to give you who are being persecuted rest when he comes in that day. And so it establishes us with God, but the persecutions themselves mature us and strengthen us as we come through them. We become stronger Christians as a result of it. Okay, so that basically gets us through the significant parts of this study. All that's left is the farewell in verses 12 through 15. By Silvanus, our faithful brother, as I consider him, I have written to you briefly, exhorting and testifying that it's the truth. This is the true grace of God in which you stand. She who is in Babylon, elect together with you, greets you, and so does Mark, my son. Greet one another with a kiss of love. And just a couple of things by way of close. If we don't get through all these, that's fine. The true grace of God. Just keep in mind that there is only one true extension of God's grace. That's through His Son. And that's where we stand. And if we are not in fellowship with Jesus Christ, if we're not abiding in the doctrine of Christ, if we're not Christians, then we have no standing with God. And He is encouraging them in the midst of persecution because you have received this true grace of God. You stand with God. And so you can accomplish what is needed. Very quickly, verse 13, she who is in Babylon, who is that? Actually, the King James Version renders it the church that is in Babylon. The church that is in, you'll notice the church that is, I think, is in italics. That's not in the text. The text actually reads, literal translation, Young's? But it does say the in Babylon. But the in is feminine. So it's a feminine reference. There are two possibilities. One, it's a woman, some woman that we don't know who it is. There have been views that it might be Peter's wife. Or it may be a congregation in Babylon. The most probable one is that this is a reference to a congregation. It's not uncommon. The Apostle Paul does it quite a bit where he sends greetings on behalf of a church. And that's probably what it is. But we don't know for a certainty. We don't even know which Babylon it is. Some people say it's Rome. It's more probably an actual city named Babylon. There was one on the Euphrates that it's referring to. We talked a little bit earlier about how maybe that's where Peter served as an elder. That's a possibility. But all of that is speculative. I just wanted you to note that. The term elect together in verse 13, she who is in Babylon, elect together. We've emphasized this a number of times, and we of course emphasize it in our study in Ephesians on Sunday mornings. The word elect means chosen. So what he's saying is, she who is in Babylon has been chosen for salvation in Christ Jesus just as you have. So the concept of election is of course misunderstood by Calvinists. But understand that we are chosen through the gospel, and those who respond as God intends to the gospel of Christ are the ones that He has chosen to be saved. So that's what is referred to with regard to election. And then the final one, and I'm glad we don't have much time on this because I really don't want to get into the weeds. What does it mean to greet one another with the kiss of love? And is that required? Or what is the kiss? And all those kinds of things. So I just want to make a couple of points. The primary points that I want to make is that we are to be affectionate toward one another. As Christians, we're part of a family. We ought to be loving one another, but it's important that we show that love. And whatever this is an expression. It's a chaste expression of love that Christians show to one another. We have analogs to that in our day and time, such as hugs, the right hand of fellowship, handshakes. But those expressions of affection, we are a family and they should be present. I'll end with this just real quick quote from Clinton Hamilton. In his commentary, he said, "The kiss of charity is an outward expression of the heart that is unselfishly interested in the welfare and good and a moral sense of the other person." That's why it's a kiss of charity or love. It's the agape love that we're talking about here. "So it ever should be among brethren that this expression of their goodwill toward one another is shown in so tender and touching way as a demonstration of what is inside, inward feeling." And that should be something that we are very good about doing for one another. I can't believe it. I got through that. I don't like teaching this fast. Appreciate very much everyone's kind attention and the 6 months we spent together. And I'm sure Bob will do a good job in James for those of you who have been here for that.